Her husband, as I mentioned, was professor of speech and not quite well known. And their second child, also Henry, was my closest friend. She felt that the children, her child Henry and another child up the street, Robert James Risley, and I needed some non-academic father figure. And she proposed that we set up a club and we hire a student from the university who would teach us the niceties of baseball, tennis, and the like. Now, my stepmother took great umbrage at this and absolutely forbade my participation.
What was her name?
My stepmother's name was Fanny. And she was called Fanny, F-A-N-N-I-E, by my brother and me. Not Aunt Fanny, but called Fanny. Fanny took great umbrage. The ostensible argument was that it led to a violation of the Sabbath. My own view was that Fanny felt that Mrs. Eubank was interfering into the running of the household. And being a not very secure woman in a very insecure position, she wanted none of this competition. I very much regret that my father acquiesced to Fanny's views, if for no other reason than this was the only, these were the only friendships as a child that I had, and I was excluded from it. As these things develop, the boys treated me as an outsider. I resented the treatment as an outsider, and in short order, they became, I suppose the appropriate phrase is enemies, and that made me very much of a loner. Now, the fact that we were Jewish was a double-edged instrument. I impressed on everyone that I was Jewish, but that was perhaps an offensive technique used in anticipation of its having of it being a defensive technique. In any event, we were obviously Jews, observant Jews, but we were not part of the Jewish community. The Jewish community, which was not that small, was a mercantile community. We were part of the academic community. Indeed, my father's position was that he was the professor's professor, almost alone of all of the professors at the university. He was literate in several European languages. He had a cultural education with considerable reading in German literature, in French literature, in Italian literature, as well as English literature. And he never forgot that his posture was that of a pre-World War I a Russian intellectual, intellectual which stressed its international rather than its national culture. When I went to high school, I was not socially integrated at all. My older brother, who had his own emotional problems, was continued to have non-Jewish boyfriends. But insofar as I recall, he showed absolutely no interest in a high school social life involving girls.
Did you have friends among Jewish people in your school years, or was it limited even in that?
As I recall, I had no Jewish friends. The one quote intellectual Jew with a family in Madison, Rabbi Max Kedushin, who was the then head of the Hillel Foundation and later became a very well-known Jewish writer and professor at the seminary in
New York. You were friends of Max Kedushin's children.
Well, he had two children. The older was approximately my age. His name was Phineas, P-H-I-N-E-A-S. I became very much interested in photography, and the Kedushins thought maybe Phineas could develop a similar interest. As is often the case, the relationship between the good relationship between the parents did not extend to the good relationship between the children. And I think that in this case, it was Phineas who was the difficult one, not I. Phineas went to the university high school, which was a tuition high school. I went to the public high school, and that was another factor. But I had no friends amongst the mercantile Jewish community. And my few friends in the high school were essentially relatively socially marginal young men.
Were they other students who had intellectual and academic qualifications that might have pleased you?
I don't think that the friendship was based on academic qualifications. I was a much better student than my two friends. One was a boy of Danish ancestry by the name of James Oland, O-E-L-A-N-D, whose father was a local real estate figure. Not a minor figure, but not a big one. The other was a boy by the name of John Smart, whose father ran an automobile agency, the Willis Knight, as I recall. Willis is W-I-L-L-Y-S, as I recall, K-N-I-G-H-T. John was a very competent mathematician, and he had discovered in the first year in college, I think a numbers theorem called Maclaurin's, M-C or M-A-C-L-A-U-E-R-N-S, I think, theorem, which made it possible to approximate log numbers. And he memorized perhaps as many as 20 or 30 of them, and enough of the log tables so that you could say to John, what is the 17th root of 1,422? And John would think for a while, and he said, well, it approximates the following. And this was his form of humor. John went to West Point after his first year at the university. I think the purpose of going to West Point was to get into the military on somewhat better basis than as a buck private in the infantry. John found West Point terribly difficult. He managed to finish reasonably well in his class, but sought an appointment in what was then the Air Corps. And at the end of World War II, when airplane maintenance in Japan was at a low ebb, he was killed in an airplane crash. As I understand it, either the wing fell off the plane or an engine fell off the wing. It was a maintenance problem, but John was very dead. It is very interesting that when John died, sometime after he died, there was a memorial service for him at the local, the neighborhood Presbyterian church. And the community was very surprised that I came. They just could not handle my being there. I did not participate in the service in the sense that I did not kneel and I did not join the prayers, and nor did I take the sacraments which were passed around. And when they came to me and I did not take it, they said, but it's only grape juice, as though wine was not on my diet. And that sort of shows the attitude.
Well, you said that it was a considerable Jewish community in Madison.
Not in the neighborhood in which I lived. They lived in the ghetto, where my grandmother lived. We lived in a neighborhood where there were no Jews. I might also mention that when John died, or was killed, his family asked me to write the obituary for the West Point memorial. And although there were, the family felt it was appropriate that the formal letters received from the army, including a form letter from General MacArthur and a form letter from, if not the chief of the staff of the army, somebody very in his office, was, they wished to have that included. The people at West Point who received the memorial wrote me and asked if I would mind if they deleted that from the official memorial. And
deleted what?
The references to the letter from General MacArthur and the letter from I believe Omar Bradley, or may have been the chief of staff by that time. In any case, passed the point past the family, and the family preferred to have it remain in. But in the course of the correspondence, as I recall, there was some comment from the West Point people that these things had a limited length, and they wanted to preserve what I said about him. Of course, what I said about him was this this wonderful capacity to spoof people by setting up tests of what appeared to be mathematical brilliance, which were dependent largely on the memorizing of 20 or 30 numbers.
And it showed his sense of humor.
Yes, that was his sense of humor and his sense of warmth.
Now, you mentioned that you weren't denied the privilege of being in this group of athletic endeavors with some of the children. Was there no organization like the Jewish Community Center with
There was no Jewish Community Center organization at all. Now, what there was, Madison had two synagogues. One was the old Orthodox synagogue, of which my grandfather was a member. Most of the Jews in Madison came from the small shtetl in some place in Russia. Our family believed, rightly or wrongly, that their business ethics was not of the best. My grandfather spent a great deal of his time, apparently, trying to mediate between errant husbands and indignant wives, to say nothing of a great deal of time trying to convey to some other members of the community, many of whom were in the what was then called the junk business, now it's called scrap business, that their sideline, to it bootlegging, gave the Jewish community a bad name. The local judge was a Jew. I can't remember his first name. His last name was Schein, S-C-H-E-I-N. He was also the Balkora and the Hazan for the smaller Jewish synagogue. He had two sons, and for a while I was friendly with the second one. His name was Ariel, A-R-I-E-L, and he introduced me to crystal sets, and I became a great manufacturer of crystal sets for my friend, for my friends, for anybody who would take them off my hands. But he went to a different high school from the one I went to, and that precluded any close friendship. My father was very friendly with a tallow processor in Madison by the name of Lewis Kalin, K-A-I-L-I-N. His wife and my mother were very close friends. My mother's also, other close friend was a German Jewish woman, the wife of a women's clothing store. Expensive clothing, I should not remember. Her friend was Esther Waldenberg. The Waldenbergs were German Jews. And I recall my mother pointing out that the Kalins, who were my father's close friends, were Russian Jews. Obviously, my father thought that Louis Kalin, who was something of a real Jewish intellectual, not only an atheist, but also, I presume, an ex-Marxian who had turned into something of an anarchist, was, he felt, much brighter than the Waldenberg. But they lived on the other side of the city, and there was no real social relationship between their children and ours and us. A third of my mother's closest friends was in the newspaper distribution business. The name was Tobias, I think it was Charles Tobias. And they had children who I think were a year or so younger than I. And I don't recall that we had much close relationship after my mother died. The women remained rather friendly with my stepmother, but friendship in the memory of my dead mother. So I was socially quite isolated from the community. I presume that another factor in the isolation was that for reasons which pertain to my own personality, I found the company of adults far more interesting than I found the company of children my own age. Part of the reason of that is I am probably the least athletic person I have ever known, and I was much embarrassed by my lack of any athletic skill. Indeed, I jump for a moment, or I guess I'm jumping around anyway. But I remember my high school math teacher, Jimmy Olin's aunt, a very demanding and self-confident woman, Mrs. Jean Cowles, C-O-W-L-E-S, once saying to me in class, "Mark Crowan, you are the most arrogant student I have ever known, and I have been teaching for more than 40 years. And I said, "Mrs. Cowles, for a person who is chosen last for every athletic team, and I can hear the people who are stuck with me groan, my problem is not arrogance. There's another word that you're looking for." This was the level of my exchange with her. But it was also true that this was my level of exchange generally with adults, that whether they liked it or not, and I'm sure they did not, I tended to consider myself to be pretty much on the same plane intellectually as they were.
Do you think some of that might have been because your father always treated you and spoke to you as an adult?
Well, surely. Surely that is part of it. Surely it is also... these conversations are in some senses useful only if one tells personal stories which are more profound than they seem on the surface. I recall when I was professor at Johns Hopkins, I once mentioned to one of my friends that I had a nightmare when I was, I believe, 9, and when I woke up, I was crying out to my father to hold me, and he was yelling at me, "Stop behaving like a child." Well, it's a rather revealing story. It's more revealing than it seems at first point. The thing that is most revealing about it is that I thought he was right. And in other words, I perceived of my weaknesses as moral lapses rather than as simply the revealing of what I actually was.
After we finished high school,
mm-hmm.
and went on to college, were you able to find other kinds of social contacts that suited you?
Not really. When I was in high school, I had decided that it was ridiculous that I should never go out with a girl. So I looked around and decided that the most likely girl to go out with was the daughter of the university librarian, a man who had been openly friendly with my parents, and who I thought, where I thought there would be the least amount of a problem. She was a rather intellectual girl. I don't think she suffered from too much social life either. In any event, I called her up and suggested we go to a movie. She thought it would be a fine idea. But when the day for the movie came, she had the predictable headache. So we didn't go out. So I do not recall that I went out at all before I went into the Army. I was sensitive about the situation and didn't want to expose myself to a rebuff.
You mean you didn't get a high school girl kiss once?
Not a single one. And what was much more ridiculous, when I went to the university and there were plenty of Jewish girls around, I didn't go out. Now, I don't think I didn't go out, I think, for several reasons, not the least of which was that I was taking a very heavy academic schedule. This is something which is hard to tell students, but I realized I was going to go into the Army. I had just graduated from high school in June of 1941. I immediately went to the University of Wisconsin Summer School to get credits. And I took, if the normal load was 15 credits for your freshman year, I took either 18 or 21, because the idea was to get as many credits as possible before you went into the Army.
Did you mention the school? Which college?
University of Wisconsin. My father was rather bothered by the fact that I had no friends in university, and he suggested that I go to the Hillel Foundation. Well, unfortunately, my relationships at the Hillel Foundation were primarily an association with the director of it, this marvelous intellectual Max Kadushin. And what I have in the way of interest in Judaism, which is not minor, comes from the series of lectures that Kadushin gave. At that period of time, Kadushin was very much interested in creative Jewish thinking. He called it organic thinking. He was very much influenced by Mordecai Kaplan and the Reconstructionist movement. He was also very literate in English literature. Lionel Trilling had been one of his proteges when he was a young rabbi. Many years later, when I was supposed to suggest a lecturer at the University of Wisconsin Hillel Foundation, my brother having left some money to have a lecture in my father's name, I proposed that Mrs. Trilling be asked to give the lecture. And I wrote her a letter explaining that Trilling and my father had been close friends, which she knew, and that Trilling and Kadushin had had a relationship. And I got a reply, a fiercely antagonistic reply, from her saying that she always regretted that Trilling had spent a summer school at Wisconsin teaching in the English department, because that had brought him back into contact with Max Kadushin, who had disapproved of their marriage. Mm-hmm. And that under no conditions would she ever lecture at the Hillel Foundation in Madison. But in any case, the point that I'm trying to say is that my father was aware of the fact that I was socially lonely, and so he suggested that I go to the Hillel Foundation. Now, if I had gone to the Hillel Foundation enough, I presume that college romances might have developed. But students at the University of Wisconsin who lived at home generally did not have their social life amongst the university students, and I lived at home.
Were there clubs or school college activities that might have...
Well, there were clubs, and I was a member of some of them, but I was not... I was a loner, and I was forever manipulating the election of my friends to leadership in the clubs, and always being very disappointed that they didn't manipulate elections to elect me. But in retrospect, I was unelectable. I was not part of the gang. It's not that the students, I think, disliked me, but I was a loner. I went to my 54th high school reunion this past summer, and I went up to the class vamp, a girl who not only bleached her hair, but she wore lipstick in class, even in 11th grade. It was, in Madison, a very advanced thing. And I went up to her. Her name was Jean Niebuhr, N-I-E-B-U-H-R. And I said, "Jean, you don't remember me, but..." And she, by this time, she was looking very closely at the badge that I was wearing, and I could see that in her mind she was moving to the nerd file and finding it hard to find me. But I said, "Jean," I said, "you don't know the sexual fantasies I used to have about you." And she blushed. And people were standing around, they said, "But Jean, when did you learn to blush?" But I never would have said anything like that as a student. Nor I might have said it, but it would have been considered quite offensive. However, this is not to suggest that I felt all that lonely. I was a loner, but like most loners, it didn't take very much to keep me busy. In any event, I did not join any organizations in the university. The whole ethos of the family was very much against fraternities or that kind of...
Went into the Army from...
I enlisted in the Army in November 1942. My stepmother and I had one hell of an argument. And so since I was thinking about enlisting anyway, I went down and enlisted and came home and announced that I had enlisted. Mm-hmm. And my father's reaction was, "Well, you probably would have been drafted in a few weeks anyway, mm-hmm. so what difference does it make?" Which I thought was no way to handle the supreme sacrifice that he was going to force on mm-hmm. me. But when I went into the Army, I became sort of the family, domestic family hero. But I think that was mostly because my brother was deferred from the draft for his industrial mm-hmm. research job, mm-hmm. and he had very little to do with the household. He ate at home, but he always was silent and always after everyone else had eaten. Mm-hmm. I think that I became the soldier hero of only to put to vex him. I was called up for service in March of 1943.
What branch?
And I scored very high in the tests and was told that I would be in the Air Corps. But I wanted to be an officer, and I thought that my poor eyesight would keep me from becoming a flyer. And so I elected not to be in the Air Force, and I went originally into anti-aircraft, and eventually, through many things, I became an Italian interpreter and a few other things. But the fact is that it was a... for me, an interesting and easy war. I was worried, as everyone who was not in combat was worried, that they were going to be in combat. But to my great surprise, I once commented to a doctor when I had gone in because my eyes were bothering me that I suffered from migraine headaches. And he said, and I happened to have one when he was there, and he saw the headache. He said, "Well, you shouldn't have been in the Army. I don't know why they ever took you." But again, it's hard to explain to people. For a young man like me, it was an obligation, a social obligation.
How long did you serve?
I was in over 3 years, and then I ended up as a master sergeant, as a sergeant major for a camp. But that was only because the real soldiers had been discharged. And I was a rather bookish fellow who knew the Army regulations very well.
Where was this?
This well, My military service started in California at a site of what is now the most expensive housing in La Jolla, California. La Jolla is J-O-L-L-A. La Jolla, California, at a camp called Camp Callan. I then went to an Italian language school at the University of Oregon. And when that was closed after 2 terms, I was stationed briefly in an interpreter's pool in Fort Warren, Wyoming, and then I served with Italian service troops in Camp Sutton in North Carolina, a miserable place, and then in what is now Fort Drum in upstate New York, and then with a group in California near Lompoc, L-O-M-P-O-C, a camp called Camp Cook. I think it's now an Air Force base. And I found working with the Italian troops very difficult because the prisoners had no sense of, they were terribly subservient, and the fellow Americans working with them sort of exploited this subservience, and I found it very disgusting.